Ever had one of those jobs, where you just knew the client was never going to be happy no matter what?
Oh yeah, I think we've all been there.
Turns out that can actually be totally legal sometimes.
Really?
Yeah, we're diving into a case that proves, well, art really is in the eye of the beholder.
Okay, I'm intrigued. Lay it on me.
Especially if that beholder happens to be the one holding the contract.
Ooh, sounds juicy.
It's the case of Gibson v. Cranage, a Michigan Supreme Court decision that set a precedent about, get this, satisfaction clauses in contracts.
Satisfaction clauses, huh? I'm guessing this is going to be relevant for anyone who does, like, commissioned work.
Oh, absolutely. So listen closely, folks. Here's the setup. An artist, Gibson, agreed to paint a portrait of Cranage's deceased daughter.
Okay, sounds pretty straightforward so far.
Right, except here's the catch. The contract said Cranage only had to pay if he was completely satisfied.
Whoa, hold on. So, like, what does completely satisfied even mean in this context? Seems kind of subjective, right? And this is why this case is so important, I think. It really highlights the power, the kind of scary power of these subjective satisfaction clauses, particularly in creative fields. Think about it. You're basically giving the client, a veto over your work.
So Cranage could just say, nope, don't like it, and that's it. Gibson gets nothing for his time and effort.
Well, sadly, that's pretty much what happened.
Come on, that just doesn't seem fair.
Well, the court saw it differently. They reasoned that, well, the contract was clear. Both Gibson and Cranage agreed to it, willingly, and there was no evidence that Cranage was acting in bad faith.
But how can you enforce a contract based on something as, I don't know, flighty as satisfaction,
Yeah.
what one person finds amazing, another might hate, right? It's also subjective.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's the core issue here, isn't it? That's subjectivity. The Michigan Supreme Court, they acknowledged that. They got that artistic taste is subjective. But they ultimately ruled that because the contract explicitly stated complete satisfaction as the condition for payment, well, Cranage's opinion was the only one that mattered.
So even if everyone else thought the portrait was like a masterpiece, Cranage could just say, "Nah, not feeling it," and refuse to pay.
That's exactly what happened. And because it would be almost impossible for Gibson to prove that Cranage was lying about his feelings,
Yeah.
the court sided with the client.
Wow.
This case really reinforces the idea that proving bad faith or malicious intent in court, it's incredibly difficult. Like, you'd need really compelling evidence to show that Cranage was deliberately being unreasonable.
Okay, so let me play devil's advocate for a sec.
Yeah.
What if Cranage was just being difficult? What if he actually kind of liked the portrait but was looking for an excuse not to pay? Like, did the court consider that possibility at all?
They did, yeah. And that's where the concept of burden of proof comes into play. Imagine it like a seesaw, okay? For Gibson to win, he would have had to, like, tip the scales of evidence heavily in his favor. He'd have to prove that Cranage's dissatisfaction was dishonest and a deliberate attempt to avoid payment. Without solid evidence, like emails or witnesses confirming Cranage's true feelings, the court wasn't going to overturn the contract just based on suspicion.
This is giving me flashbacks to every time I've heard the phrase, get it in writing. It might seem like a cliche, but this case shows exactly why that's so important.
Absolutely. Gibson v. Cranage isn't just some obscure art world drama. It has huge implications for anyone involved in subjective work, really, where satisfaction is a factor. Think software developers, designers, consultants, all of them. You're so right about that get it in writing thing. This case is like exhibit A for why that matters.
Yeah.
It throws a major wrench into that whole idea of what good enough even means, right?
Totally. And it raises so many questions, especially for like freelancers and artists and, well, anyone who deals with these satisfaction clauses, which is like a lot of people.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so for all the creatives and, independent contractors out there listening, what are the big takeaways from Gibson v. Cranage? Like, what can we actually learn from this case so we don't, end up in the same boat as Gibson?
Yeah, I think the biggest lesson here is to really truly understand just how much power those subjective satisfaction clauses give to the client. It's a ton of leverage.
Yeah.
It really doesn't matter if your work is objectively good. If the client's not happy, they might not have to pay, even if, their reasons seem completely unreasonable to anyone else.
So how do you protect yourself? Right. If you're the one creating the work, I mean, it feels like you're just setting yourself up to be taken advantage of.
Well, I mean, if you zoom out and look at the big picture here, it all comes down to having a really, really solid contract.
Yeah.
And when you're working in, subjective fields, that means being incredibly specific about what satisfaction actually means. You can't leave any room for, like, interpretation.
So, like, what does that look like in practice? Can you give me some, like, real-world examples?
Sure, absolutely. Let's say you're a web designer, right? Instead of just saying the client has to be satisfied with the final product, you specify that they need to provide feedback within, say, 2 weeks, right? Or you agree on a specific number of revision rounds beforehand. This way, you're not stuck in this endless loop of revisions trying to please someone who, well, might never actually be happy.
Right, you got to set those boundaries. It takes the emotion out of it and makes it, more objective.
Exactly. And it also kind of addresses that whole question of good faith we were talking about earlier, right? Like, if the client keeps coming back with super vague demands or unreasonable requests, you have a reason to push back and say, hey, we agreed on 3 rounds of revisions and we've already done those. We got to stick to the contract.
Right, so documentation is key. The clearer that contract is, the less room there is for anyone to, try to misinterpret things or like manipulate the situation. But what about those times when the client really is just intentionally being difficult? What if they're using that satisfaction clause as an excuse to not pay at all? Like, what then?
Yeah, well, that's kind of a gray area, isn't it? And that's exactly where documentation becomes your best friend.
Yeah.
You've got to keep detailed records of all communication, feedback, revisions, everything that shows you've been acting in good faith
Oh, okay.
and that you're fulfilling your end of the deal. So, like, if there is a dispute, you can show exactly what happened, right? You can say, okay, look, here's the feedback I got, here are the changes I made, and here's the client repeatedly changing their mind or, dragging things out. It's like a paper trail that protects you.
Right, so it's all about building that case piece by piece.
Exactly. Think of it like you're building a wall brick by brick. Every email, every note, every revision, it all becomes evidence. It makes it way harder for someone to say they were genuinely dissatisfied when you've got proof that you were responsive.
And you were paying attention to their needs,
Yep.
right? Yeah. Which makes me think the court in Gibson v. Cranage didn't think that Cranage was acting in bad faith, but what if he was just being a jerk?
Yeah.
Like, where's the line between someone who's genuinely not happy and someone who's, I don't know, trying to pull a fast one?
Yeah, that is a really tough question, and it often comes down to the specifics of the situation. But clear communication up front can really help prevent this kind of problem. You shouldn't be afraid to have those maybe kind of uncomfortable conversations early on,
Right.
about expectations, about potential challenges, about how you're going to handle disagreements if, if they come up.
Proactive is always better than reactive.
Oh, totally. Addressing things head on is always a better
Yeah.
strategy than, waiting till things explode and then trying to clean up the mess.
This whole thing's got me thinking, about like the tension between creative freedom and, well, your obligations in a
Oh,
contract.
yeah, for sure.
On the one hand, you've got like artists putting their heart and soul into their work. But then on the other hand, you've got the clients, right? And they're essentially like buying a feeling or an emotional response. It's a tricky balance, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. The law is always trying to like find that middle ground
Yeah.
between protecting creative expression and upholding the idea that, hey, people should be able to enter into contracts, even if those agreements, involve subjective criteria.
So where does that leave us for our listeners, especially those who are thinking, well, maybe I should just avoid these satisfaction clauses altogether?
Well, you could, but that might not always be, practical or even what you want.
Yeah, true.
Because satisfaction clauses, they can, they can serve a purpose. They can help make sure the clients get what they paid for, especially when what they want is hard to define, in some objective kind of way.
So it's not about avoiding them entirely. It's about like using them wisely and strategically.
Yeah, exactly. If you're going to go that route and use one, you got to make sure it's super clear what it means and that both sides, they fully understand the consequences. Clients got to be reasonable in their expectations, and creatives, well, they need to protect themselves with clear communication, good documentation, and of course, a really solid contract.
This whole deep dive into Gibson v. Cranage has really given us a lot to think about, huh?
It really has.
Like, it reminds us that contracts aren't just about, legal mumbo jumbo. They're about relationships and expectations. And that sometimes kind of messy intersection of art and, well, making a living.
Couldn't have said it better myself. And maybe, maybe it leaves us with one final question, something to think about as we go forward.
Ooh, I like this. Hit me.
In a world where, good enough is so often the goal, how do we actually like value something as intangible as satisfaction. That's a good one, right?
It is. That's something for all of us to consider, I think, as we navigate our own contracts and, well, all our creative endeavors, really. So until next time, folks, keep it legal and keep it creative.